I really wanted to control what laptops and devices our employees took to China. You know, a lot of that was a way to demonstrate to our customers that we were concerned about a government gaining access to their data. If you really think about it, there's a lot of employees who work for us today that have potential affiliations with these governments.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Great to see you guys as always. Thanks for joining. I know since our last episode, something that I experienced was that we had the FSISAC Fall Summit in Atlanta. It was the first time there was an event in Atlanta, which is really cool to me. It seems like in every group where there were, you know, 5 to 10 people, there was one or two that were podcast listeners. That's awesome. So thanks everybody who's listening out there. Let's jump right in. The other stuff that's happened, look, the biggest thing is the election. There's enough podcasts out there with political content, but I think there's some implications here, whether it's geopolitics or capital markets or venture or interest rates or anything else. One thing all of us saw right away was that quick stock market bump, and I'd like to think it seems to have had a technology bend.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily a technology bend. Traditionally, the markets go up when Republicans go into power and then go down when Democrats do. It's just a standard swing of things, if you will. One of the things that went up quite a bit was crypto, and you can imagine why as well. It's interesting, partly because it's going to create a more stable crypto economy, which will have its pluses and minuses as well.
Yeah, I have some crypto exposure too, and I noticed the same thing. And or more specifically, I have some Coinbase stock exposure in addition to that. One thing that always frustrated me from being an early Coinbase investor was that the price correlates with the value of the major cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. And I think to the layperson, they just think that, you know, Coinbase is Bitcoin, and when it's worth more, so is Coinbase. And to me, it's a big financial services company, you know, full of execution, and like, there's a lot of diversity of revenue streams and so on. So I, as long as those two correlate, I feel like the world hasn't gotten it. And then when they start to diverge and cryptocurrencies, just like the price of oil and gold and everything in between, can vary, but the juggernaut that actually, you know, controls the ins and outs of these markets stays on a rise based on their performance, then I think people will really start to appreciate Coinbase.
Well, I guess you can then look at your E-Trades and the Schwabs of the world and see if their stock fluctuates with the market as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was certainly close to that, right, at ICE and the New York Stock Exchange. And while I think, for one, the equity markets and the NYSE in particular were a small enough piece of our pie. You know, last time it mattered to me and I had a quote, it was like 15 to 20% of revenue at the time. It might be more or less now. So that helped a little bit in kind of downplaying the impact of equity prices. But between that and the fact that the balance of our exposure was in this massive amount of often inversely correlated products and commodities, right? Whether it's agricultural contracts or energy. So something was always popping off and something was always swinging. Something was always in the dumps. And we were pretty divorced from that because it was transaction-based revenue. And when you're coming in or out, we were still getting paid. So as long as these crypto exchanges can position themselves similarly and benefit, then you know that'll help, I believe.
The other perspective I would have with the election is simply that when with the geopolitical aspects of things, with Trump being cozy with the Russians and not so cozy with the Chinese, it's going to create some interesting dynamics, especially as it pertains to what we should see from attackers entrenching themselves into U.S. infrastructure and whatnot. You know, we already know that Chinese are actively doing that, and Salt Typhoon with the intrusion into our telecom networks being an example of that. You know, that's going to continue, but I wonder what the gameplay is going to be like for the Russian side. Will the Russians continue to push the boundaries, knowing that Trump's in place and they're, you know, he's going to be a bit more friendly to the Russians? So that particular perspective is still to be seen. It'll be, and of course, as we all know, Trump, Russia and China and North Korea and Iran have this friendly relationship amongst themselves. I see the administration being friendly to Russia, but continuing to be really harsh with China. How that's going to play out is going to be quite interesting.
I agree. I couldn't agree more with Sunil. I think we've already started. I've read articles about how the Chinese government is concerned about how North Korea is cozying up more to Russia. And Russia is trying to exchange and share more technology, especially in ballistic missiles. That's not making China feel comfortable. It's really going to be interesting what this is going to play out. We talk about Ukraine and Ukraine, but I think the biggest trouble area is Taiwan. I'm possibly more concerned now with something happening in Taiwan where China does try to invade Taiwan.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people were predicting that's going to happen over the next, you know, 2, if not 3 administrations.
Yeah.
Well, no, not administrations, 2-3 years. So 2027, that's the time frame, and that will be within this administration. So we'll see how that plays out.
One thing that was really concerning, I was talking to a former colleague yesterday, and I didn't realize that Taiwan has a plan that in the event that China invades Taiwan, Taiwan will blow up the chip manufacturing companies and blow it up. So the Chinese government don't get a hold of a lot of these newer chip technology. Well, that's interesting because that's going to impact the whole world, right? America is still not manufacturing chips fast enough to compensate for losing Taiwan. This is like a major major issue that could send shockwaves for, you know, you think about AI and forget about AI. That's all going to get delayed if that were to happen in Taiwan.
Yeah, you know, there's building the cyber nexus to this, Dmitry Alperovich, which a lot of us will know, being one of the original founders of CrowdStrike and going on to a lot more. He has a lot of interest in this area. He has a think tank and he thinks about the Taiwan situation a lot. And he just published a book, I don't know, in the last 2 months, I think it was, called World on the Brink. And I think that's a great one. It starts out with a hypothetical, how it could happen. It talks about 2027. And I saw him come and talk on the kind of the book signing tour about it. And someone's asking about the plant meltdown, the TSMC meltdown, right? Whether it's Taiwan has a kill switch and they'll do it, or whether the U.S. has a role in it, I've heard different ideas, but whatever. But he didn't see that being much of a deterrent. He didn't. You know, he said that that's not going to make much of a difference, certainly to China. Looking more broadly, one thing that I think is pretty interesting. You kicked off Sunil mentioning that the Trump administration being cozier with Russia than China. That's certainly true. I mean, we got sound bites like crazy. I don't think it's a philosophical matter though. I don't think you could have predicted. I don't think you could have like taken the whole policy with the Trump administration and you know separated from these other regimes, said like, oh, that's compatible with Russia and not compatible with China. I think it's more opportunistic and situational, meaning it could change overnight really quick. Even with the existing political strategy of both of those nations, I think we could see a reversal just depending on, you know, personal relationships and I would use the word quid pro quo if it was 6 years ago before that was laced with a lot more, but literal quid pro quo, literal negotiating and deal making and okay, well, if you do this and we'll do this. So to me, that instability is probably more concerning than the idea of just a direct antagonistic relationship with China or too cozy of a relationship with Russia.
So what I was referring to in some respects is actually an opportunity. The opportunity being to drive wedges between the quadfecta, if you will, of Iran, China, North Korea, and Russia. As Mario mentioned earlier, there is China's very unnerved by the fact that North Korea is helping Russia, because effectively North Korea for a long time is considered a puppet regime by China, right? And still exerts a significant control over, or used to exert significant control. But if they start establishing tighter connections back to Russia, then they lose that control as well. Is there honor among thieves is another way to think about this. You have these four countries that seem dependent upon one another for support, but at the same time are willing to backstab each other as well.
This isn't a pivot. This might be like a sidetrack, but this is super interesting. So travel security policy. What? I'm going to tie this into this. I had a conversation yesterday, actually, with a customer. And they basically said, hey, we're going to have employees in traveling to China. And traditionally, we would say, beware, and you know, all of the, I'll say it, hack lore. I'll say it's like, beware, the minute you go there, the maids are going to come in and take your laptop out of the safe and take all the screws out and take the hard drive out and do what maids do with hard drives and a lot of stuff that just didn't add up to me. Not the least of which is that nobody just sets a camera there and videos the maid taking about the hard drive and puts us all to bed. But anyway, so they were saying like, hey, we don't want to let people bring their equipment to China, right? And what I came back to it with was, and the way I've always handled travel security policy was extradition, right? Because what I ran into was, okay, if we're not comfortable with China, that's okay, but give me a rubric. Why are we not comfortable with China? And a rubric that will also include other nations that are similar, like what is it about China? What could change that would change the approach? And what I ultimately concluded was some nations, I mean, just have a strategic initiative, like espionage in the case of China. But generally, the reason why countries are unfavorable has to do with the fact that you could either proxy through them or actually be in them and not get extradited. And so we see a lot coming out of Russia on the organized crime side because they can turn a blind eye to it and people can't get pulled out of there. No. China's true on the extradition side. If there were a bunch of criminal enterprises operating in China, we'd be in rough shape. But A, the government doesn't turn a blind eye as much to kind of rogue activity.
Yeah.
And B, the internet sucks.
Yeah.
Right? It sucks to, who wants to proxy through China to do all your C2 and the crap keeps falling over and the latency is awful and all of that kind of stuff. So by that argument, I think China is a much safer place if the threat profile is not sabotage, nation state level sabotage, if the threat profile isn't espionage, if you're not Lockheed Martin, but rather you're a commercial company operating in the mid-market in the United States. I'm much more worried about places where organized crime and the ultimate objective of ransomware or transactional fraud can take place. And I don't see those being hot on China. So I'm saying, nah, go nuts. Rock into China. If somebody takes your phone and demands your PIN, I don't care if you're in Norway or China or anywhere. Let's reboot it. Let's reset it. Let's reset your creds. Let's report it. But I don't want to have a special policy for China that I don't apply to all non-extradition countries, right? Morocco, Ukraine, Russia, and onward. To me, they're all equals because of that threat profile. Do you guys agree?
So the time I visited China when I was working for the bank, I brought a laptop. It was meant to be a decoy.
Burner laptop?
A burner?
And no, it was actually a decoy too.
Oh, okay.
Oh. Ooh.
I imaged the whole thing, MD hashed it. I put on the laptop my business card, which very specifically said VP of R&D. Okay. You know, R&D being a particular of interest.
And were then you a Bank of America then, Sunil?
Yes. So okay. I put a...
sorry to ask so many questions, but did your business card say Bank of America or was it a fake corporation?
Oh, no. It was
Bank of America. Your business card. Okay, right.
Yeah. And I put a camera in the room to see if anything would happen. And I was actually pretty amazed at how meticulous the maids were in not touching the laptop. Like, they did not even try to touch. I mean, they were like very careful about just cleaning around it. And did not disturb it whatsoever. Okay. Now,
sample of one.
Yes.
But right.
But it was interesting, and you know, not that I was particularly a target, but just to know that the maids were very conscientious about not actually disturbing anything that would otherwise cause.
Trying to fight stereotypes.
You know, it's interesting. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but. Say whatever you want to say about the Chinese government. They do strive on stability. They want stability. Ask yourself this. When's the last time you wanted to buy a product from Russia as opposed to wanting to buy a product from China?
Surrounded by them.
Exactly. So one government strives in chaos. One could argue Russia is one of those governments that strives in chaos, creating mayhem in the world. Because they really don't have anything to export except mayhem, quite honestly. China's different. China's looking to build a framework of like-minded folks to build industry, business, and stability to continue to grow.
So look, between Sunil's anecdote, I mean, sample of one, yeah, but supported by logic. I mean, imagine that you tell me what your budget would ask would be if I told you you need to intercept and have people sneak into every hotel room, extract the hard drive, and then God forbid you get the freaking data. Now you're really screwed because what are you going to do with this data? You have a data lake and grind through it and read all these stupid emails from Sunil to Mario and Jerry about dumb stuff.
Well, actually, so that's actually what's really interesting about recent developments. So what used to be the case of having to spend tons of people time digging through things, we now have this thing called a large language model that allows us to quickly find sensitive content. And we're starting to see that now, obviously, with info stealers too. Lots of content that's been swept up. And really, all that is needed is attention. Okay, to borrow the phrase for large language models. You just need attention on the things that give you the opportunity to make money. And I think that's why we're seeing this massive rise of info stealers, or at least not info stealers, but rather the capitalization on the content that's already been stolen by info stealers, and to use that to wreak more havoc.
Okay. Well, let's talk about info stealers. Hey, to put the travel security policy to bed, do you guys feel that the average company needs to be more concerned with China than other non-extradition countries?
When it comes to device policy, I would say probably not too different. But when it comes to other sort of things that you need to be cautious about, especially when it comes to executives and their ability to hold you hostage, I should point it out. You know, not the extradition piece, but rather the individual person being in that country, I would say I would be more concerned.
In China, Sunil? You would think that in China?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Now, are you talking about, I mean, because Mario, maybe you're like me, you're like, well, you know, whatever happened to Mexico or you know, Colombia, that kind of thing. But you mean the litigation hostage? Like there was
Canadian.
Sorry?
Canadians, for example. Canadians held the Huawei CEO.
For geopolitical reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yes, kind absolutely.
Tit for tat thing. Yeah, but you would know if you're eligible.
I had a friend who went to Russia, didn't come back because they were held as a pawn.
I really wanted to control what laptops and devices our employees took to China. You know, even a couple of years ago, and I was pretty strict about it. I would no, you're not using company laptop. No, you're not going to be able to access Gmail or Slack or whatever that is while you're in China. And you know, a lot of that was I'll readily admit was a way to demonstrate to our customers that we were concerned about, you know, potentially a government gaining access to their data through means. But if you really think about it, there's a lot of employees who work for us today that have potential affiliations with these governments. So while we think, you know, we do all this kabuki, I think now it's kabuki theater, especially going to China, and I'll be the one, I'll readily admit, it's kabuki theater. Because I think the bigger problem, in all sincerity, are some employees that are plants or that could potentially become affiliates of some of these governments that we are not so friendly with.
Yeah, and that's a lot easier than trying to man in the middle of your hotel traffic.
Totally.
It's just so technically stupid.
Totally.
Yeah, okay. Hey, so I do want to talk about InfoStealer because that's been around for a while. And, right, just I'm defining that. Correct me if I'm wrong or if you have a different definition. But the whole class or family of malware that's sitting on endpoints and doing things like dumping browser credential stores and decrypting them because you can if you're on the actual device, figuring out saved passwords and the URLs that they go to. So that's been coming up a whole lot. And in particular, the first thing it came up with was about this arrest that was in the news, finally, of the guy, I guess it's a guy who was using InfoStealer to find people's credentials into Snowflake that were single factor they hadn't strengthened and therefore logging into Snowflake and mining their data. Is that the kill chain that you would have expected, Mario, so to speak? And is this a plague or anything new, or is it, you know, just the same old, same old?
I read an article, not this particular one, but discussing the techniques that Alexander Muka employed to target Snowflake customers. And they were pretty rudimentary stuff. There was nothing special about this guy. He didn't write any custom code, at least from what I've read, that was great or anything. That's kind of scary to me, because that means that any script kiddie can do some interesting damage against companies where your services, your SaaS applications, are publicly exposed to the internet. You have to, right? You have to get people to access. Well, not have to. You could have it controlled by your IPY listing or ACLs. But generally, a lot of these SaaS applications are accessible through the public internet for most companies. And if that's the case, the creds become the easiest. Well, I think, Jerry, you mentioned this. It's people are not hacking. They're just using your credentials to gain access to your environment. I forget what the term was that you used, Jerry, or you highlighted. But it's not. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to do this stuff, right? It doesn't. Buy these credentials from the dark web and start testing them. Go to town on them. And there are websites that have these credentials available for you to go test. It's easy. That's my point. And one additional comment on this topic, I do have to admit that it was pretty fast. They got this guy really quickly. If this event's happening April of this year, they busted him within 5-6 months. I thought that was pretty fast, folks.
Well, why is that? Because in my experience, or at least my opinion, it was that you had to like kind of break down doors or leverage trade-off relationships with foreign jurisdictions to expose sources, all these things. Like, you could do that, but it wasn't worth it for most cases. Was there something about this attack pattern that they trip over some Snowflake customer record that's really important? Like, what? Why did somebody, or was it just that easy to bust them?
This guy was sloppy. That's all I'm going to say. And he's coming from Canada. Canada and America have, I mean, Canada has a really good relationship with the United States. I bet you if you try to do that in a country that doesn't have friendly relations with the United States, it would be a lot harder.
So, you know, on this InfoStealer topic, right, there was it was a cool one. So pivoting from InfoStealer and pervasiveness of it to SaaS targeting, right, that's where the data is nowadays. It's not just in the cloud, it's in or in cloud service providers and in you know, databases and that kind of thing. But it's in Snowflake, it's in well, that was a bad example, but it's in ServiceNow, it's in Salesforce, it's and so on. So there was this great bug bounty write up from this guy who says that he found in one of those cred dumps, he found an InfoStealer victim that had a I guess it was a ServiceNow domain, and I used to love ServiceNow because they were willing to assign a subdomain for each customer, which was really important because we did DNS-based restrictions. So we could say you can't get to ServiceNow at all, but you could get to our ServiceNow, and it was so nice of them. Downside is the customer name is in the damn domain. So someone like this saw Microsoft.whatever.servicenow.com. Tried it out, single factor worked, went in there, did some really cool stuff, like he switched over to an API connection using the creds, was able to dump a bunch of hot stuff. So, you know, a few themes there. One, InfoStealer is just mining creds mindlessly, doesn't know what they are, but putting them all in databases that people can then later on go through and start utilizing. Two, all the data worth stealing now is on the internet and in SaaS platforms and no longer in company-owned infrastructure, target-owned infrastructure, right? And three, single factor is still a thing? How is that even possible?
Service accounts. Yeah.
I think there are a couple of things to unpack here. So first is that it was a bug bounty report, and this begs the first question around, is are credentials found through InfoStealers within scope, should it be within scope for a bug bounty? If you think about it, the InfoStealer market is a bug bounty of its own, where you're buying the credential. And you could argue that some of these companies could proactively buy these credentials anyway on their own, right? So that's their bug bunny. You can either pay it to the group that stole it, or maybe you pay it to the person that found that did mine for it and then let you know that, hey, this credential's out there. I think it's fair to say that if you haven't already, you as an organization aren't actively doing this, then, and if someone brings it to your attention, I would say that the person that brought it to your attention does fairly should receive some reward for doing so. Yeah. So I don't think it's necessary. If I understand correctly, Microsoft did not issue any bug bounty for this finding.
They didn't pay the really?
Mm-mm. No.
Because it was out of scope.
The guy's blog write-up, he's basically saying, like, look, they acknowledged me and said, great, we're not going to pay anything.
Yeah.
Which is shocking to me. I mean, once I read into it, it apparently shouldn't be shocking because Microsoft apparently has a reputation for that kind of behavior. Huh. But it's, I mean, to me, the way I always did, I mean, you tried to write out scope statements up front so that you wouldn't have to argue later. And I bet that's the case here. I bet it said somewhere, info stealer, stolen cred, don't count. But it was just to keep someone from, like, kind of litigating against something that was just a stupid finding. But at the end of the day, if the finding was hot, then thank you. This is the best money we've spent this week. So,
yeah.
By the way, the guy, he figured out a few things. Like, he didn't just say, oh, you have a cred on InfoStealer. That's not so interesting. He found, A, there's a cred on InfoStealer that's still active. B, you allow single-factor authentication on service accounts to ServiceNow. And arguably, yeah. C, you allow that to probably lots of SaaS platforms. These are all to-do items that are hot now, right, that should be in the risk register for Microsoft as soon as this report came in, just to burn all those down. And then on top of that, he figured out that while your team may have gotten a false sense of security by concluding that this account couldn't do much, that I was able to pivot over to using the REST API and found some endpoints. And that's yet another risk register entry. Wow, these exposed endpoints allow someone with less privilege than you thought to pull down a bunch of sensitive data.
That's crazy.
You should be, I mean, yeah. That's money that much better spent than any of the other security crap that people keep buying.
We had, you know, people, you have these quote unquote researchers who constantly are looking at GitHub or GitLab in the cloud and looking for credentials stored by mistake or intentionally in people's codes. And, you know, invariably we get contacted by them, and 99.99% of the time was customers' credentials that they had accidentally or whatever, intentionally without realizing the ramifications of it. And we would connect, you know, we would alert the customer of the situation, and we would ask the researcher who found that in GitHub or GitLab to go to our bounty program and go and upload their claim, and you get paid for it for finding that. And those were one or two C's. This guy, if you're telling me, I can't believe Microsoft didn't pay. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and I don't want to go too far in this rabbit hole in this one, but consider a couple things. One, Joel Sullivan had a bug bounty program for Uber, and they did not count that bug bounty program as the federal government still prosecuted him despite him trying to use that finding under the auspices of a bug bounty program. Here it's almost kind of the opposite. You have what you could argue is a breach, right? A pretty significant breach.
Totally.
That was reported in a way that was responsible, but nonetheless, it is a pretty significant breach. And I don't know if there's a consent order under Microsoft at the current time. I know, because, you know, they have had some pretty bad fiascos recently, right? So these sort of things, I think, will find its way at some point towards, like, okay, look, you got some real problems here. And it's not just Microsoft. It's a whole bunch of other companies mm-hmm. who have the same situation.
But just to be clear, like, to tie those two things together, I think it's a slippery or a dangerous Rubicon mm-hmm. to ever hint that a bug bounty it could be a breach. the reason I mentioned that is that there's all kinds of, every reg now has disclosure notification requirements. It's about when you have to tell either the public or the regulator or whatever it is, or your customers. And I think the world is still safely in the, hey, a bug bounty researcher found something, absolutely zero implication on disclosure requirements. And that has to stay that way, or we will absolutely freeze the research, right? Because, I mean, I remember this. We bought a company, and I said, oh, cool, we're going to enroll you in a bug bounty program. We're going to red team it. And they said, well, we had contractual agreements with a bunch of customers saying if we have a breach, we have to notify them. And so if we have a red team come in and they're able to get the data, we're going to have to tell JP Morgan. Like, no, that's not true. You're not reading that right. And they were just scared of their security program looking like crap, right? That's really what it was. But, you know, any lawyer that hears that, mid-level lawyers, like, what? Oh, a contract? Okay, stop. No, you can't do it. It freezes everything. Mm-hmm. And I had to fight and burn a lot of political matches to get through that and actually do the testing. So, we need to stand behind the fact that, and particularly like to the Joe Sullivan and Uber point, especially for a pre-agreed bounty agreement, and if the finding comes in right through the standard channel, that can't trigger notification requirements or the SEC public disclosure or anything else like that. So everyone listening out there, do not freeze, don't pause, do the hell out of some bug bounties and red teaming and find all your data.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so...
I think going back to, why is this becoming more prevalent? I was JPMC was holding a conference last week or 2 weeks ago, a bunch of startups. Yeah. And, this is just kind of observations. It's not written in stone or anything, but there seems to be a realization a pattern that from companies now that had heavily gone cloud, heavily gone SaaS, that the tide is kind of turning and they're kind of moving things that are more critical to either more on-prem or running inside the client's own. Yeah.
What kind of companies are we talking about here? Just broadly, because I'm thinking it's a JP Morgan conference. Did that have some kind of attendee bias built in, or was it real early stage?
Interesting.
Stuff?
Yeah, no, they were saying that, and again, I don't want to misrepresent anything JPMC said. I'm just hearing what I thought was the big message was that from their talks with other companies, their understanding is things are starting to get more into this, I don't want to say hybrid, but your critical applications are not necessarily only going to be running in somebody else's cloud deployment as a SaaS. And they're starting to say, one of the big pushes for this, quite honestly, is AI. It's really expensive, apparently, to be running this AI services in public clouds. Oftentimes, there's not enough of the resources available to them. I didn't realize that. I didn't know that. And if they are, they're very expensive. So people are having to have second thoughts about, going all, SaaS or all cloud in some public cloud. There seems to be some sort of move back to the to a hybrid world. I think this example of some of these SaaS applications that are in the public internet, people need to take, especially security teams, need to be more involved in the SaaS applications. I think we do a disservice to organizations by not being more actively monitoring and understanding how these SaaS applications are being used by our businesses. I think a lot of these companies are deploying. It's really easy to deploy these things, really easy to get them started. It's really hard to maintain a secure environment.
So if there is any kind of pattern of a move back towards anything close to on-prem or hybrid on-prem, I can't help but say the only driver is economic. And that's the reason. Remember, nobody wanted to go to cloud because of security, security. Oh, it's a little bit cheaper. Get out of the way, security. Shut up. And right now, the opposite is true. And if anybody's coming back, it's just because GPUs are too expensive by the time they're middlemanned by all the cloud providers. And I remember seeing this. I worked with a startup in the healthcare space, believe it or not, that was doing some ML work three or four years ago. And I remember looking at their attack surface, and it was all cloud, except for the rack in so-and-so's house. you know, because it was the economics weren't there. So I think there may be a maybe temporary move back, but don't for a second think it's because of security or because people worried about the security in SaaS platforms, for better or worse.
Yeah, I think most people know my pets and cattle, or are familiar with my pets and cattle analogy and the DIE triad. So I also have an adage associated with the pets and cattle analogy, which is pets on-prem, cattle in the cloud. So if it's moving on-prem, you're really declaring that to be a pet, and it has to be secured as such. And more than likely, that pet is going to become their new legacy system. So good luck with that.
I will say, in defense of SaaS, though, if anyone had argued, look, it's a consolidation of effort and security muscle, so we put everything into one big vendor, and ServiceNow has the best chance of getting it right, Snowflake has the best chance of getting it right, that model, I'd say, has been upheld strongly. I mean, any kind of breach
Even
that
Microsoft.
You hear about with any of these SaaS provider names in them, the SaaS provider was rarely, if ever, actually breached. It's usually like the stuff that happened with Snowflake in the news, right? No actual compromise of Snowflake any more than Swift as a payments network. That's not been breached either, but it's where the money is, and Snowflake's where the data is. So that's where ultimately people went. So, and when you put stuff back on-prem, it's the old nightmare we all remember living through. It was just rolling the dice every day to see which things were going to get popped.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think the one exception to that one in terms of the SaaS provider not getting breached is Microsoft, because they did get breached, and you know, O365 was owned as a part of that. But that said, I think even then, I still agree with you that they will still do a better job than, you know, the aggregate of all of us. And that whatever breach occurred, that at least that specific type of breach won't occur again. Will they get breached again at some point? Sure. Just as much as any of these other SaaS providers will. But they will have a much better chance of defending it than we will.
Yeah. They can put a lot more resources in and getting things done right into these build-outs and on and on. All right, so SaaS is here to stay, Mario, despite your best effort. I didn't think the West Coast guy was going to try to argue for on-prem, by the way.
Hey, I'm not arguing on-prem, man. I'm just telling you what I'm hearing. I'm just saying...
That's our new running joke.
Well, those cows that are out there, you know, you can guard those cows, right? You can put guardsmen and protect them and make sure they're fully vaccinated and they're clean and they're well taken care of. Don't just miss them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you one advantage of on-prem, of course, is that if all of the employees in your on-prem office are using your on-prem infrastructure, there's no need for it to be sitting there on the internet. And you know, it used to be, I was just talking about this in lecturing in class the other day, I was talking about AppSec and like some architectural fundamentals you should ask for. And I wrote this back when it was a hybrid world and not everything in the cloud. And I was saying, like, administrative interfaces should always have a completely different pathway and architecture than user interfaces. So if you have a public facing application that does X, Y, and Z, then it's, you know, url.company.com. And that if when your administrators are logging in to turn customers on and off, to check their balances, to support them over the phone, whatever it is, it should be an inaccessible thing. It should be internal. It should require VPN at a minimum and not be like same exact login page. When you log in as customer support, you just have this God mode. It should be a very different interface. And that used to be possible to say. And then with everything being born in the cloud now, of course the interfaces are the same. It's all public facing. So one good thing about on-prem was that at least it was possible, because by default things were not on the internet and you had to go out of your way to enable them to touch the internet, that then at least you could say, well, only the customer-facing interfaces work. So I do pine away for the on-prem days in a few ways for security. Shifting gears here, what's going on in the EU with this new product liability directive? Sunil, you got some info on this thing?
So last month in October, they released this new product liability directive that really pushed the whole expectation around what software liability might look like. I had the opportunity to be able to be in some of the earlier deliberations around the national cyber strategy when there's a little mentioned, it's a very small mention about software liability as a consideration. And it was included in when it was being considered for inclusion in the national cyber strategy. You know, there's a lot of contention about how far did the U.S. want to go and pushing for software reliability. And the inclusion in this national cyber strategy was, we thought, like a small little step just to say, hey, let's just float the, let's just see how, you know, what the reception will be. Okay. And as you may imagine, lots of discussion occurred. What I thought was just interesting about the EU directive is, I mean, they just bust through the wall and said, okay, hey, this is, we're going to now update the liability rules to basically say that that the manufacturer of the product, which, by the way, can include individuals, okay, individual developers, not just the company, but individual developers?
At the whole...
Yeah, yeah. So that's, and I have to make sure I read that right, but I'm pretty sure that's the implication of what the current directive suggests. And of course, now it's gonna, it needs to take actual form. You know, it's just a directive, and then the law, it has to be turned into an actual law, and then 2 years from now, it goes into effect. So the earliest it would go into effect would be 2026. But that said, the directive does include, does put liability on the developer as well, which is kind of crazy in my view. But that said, we'll see what happens with that, right? So this obviously has significant implications across the board, especially if it overreach. In my view, overreaches a bit in terms of putting liability beyond a company into an actual developer, because you can imagine what happens at that point. Like, one, you know, what happens with open source? It just, like, who would volunteer to ever write a new form of open source, or, you know, mm-hmm. or at least you can imagine a whole bunch of disclaimers. You think
that's
the
right.
ULOs
not allowed
are,
for use in the EU. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, it'll be interesting how that pans out, and what sort of accommodations are going to have to be made to be able to actually use any of the software.
So in your understanding of this, would it have implications if the CrowdStrike scenario had played out under this?
If the product creates some sort of damage in that regard, then yes, it would have, at least the way I understand the current directive, then CrowdStrike would actually have had to have damages. Now, the question is, but like, to what degree? And I think that's something that is harder to anticipate what the limits of that liability are going to be, because it doesn't make sense for these liability laws to bankrupt a company either, right? Especially if it's something that was there's negligence, and then there's, you know, trying to do the best you can, and still it creates these sort of issues. So that those are things that have been considered in the directive. But yeah, I think I would say in this particular case, if this law were in place 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, I should say, yeah, CrowdStrike would have much harder case on their hand.
So with the EU, you know, going in this direction, and I think it's hard to argue that the U.S. is not going to go in the opposite direction when it comes to regulation broadly, up to and including product liability over the next 4 years. It's going to create this arbitrage, right? So we're going to have this widening gap in both directions. And look, it's not about companies getting started in these jurisdictions. It's about them servicing the jurisdiction, right? Because it's the market that you operate in and you're licensed in. So, I mean, at the end of the day, is this going to mean that is there going to be a tax? Is there going to be a regulation tax?
It's not a regulation tax as much as the cost of doing business is just going to go up. So for anyone in the EU, you're going to have to pay a higher premium for the software that you use.
Yeah, regulation tax. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is not a literal tariff, but I mean when CrowdStrike says, here's your quote, and in euros, it's not, you know, exchange rate, but it's 2x because we're baking in all of our liability and probably just giving that straight to an insurer and for litigation risk. But yeah, is that going to happen? And what are the long-term economic implications of that? And will that cause us to die? Will whispers of that cause us to be killed off?
Well, so I have mixed feelings on this, partly because I think product liability is actually an important facet towards making both safer and more secure products, right? And that includes software products too.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a question of how quick, it's more of a question of, are we ready for this at the speed that the EU wants to go versus the speed at which the US wanted to go? Because you have almost two extremes here. The US wanted to go at a snail's pace, and the EU wants to go at ludicrous speed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you researched whether there's state-level initiatives around this type of thing in the U.S.? Because I'm just, and the reason I'm asking is, when I think about privacy, we had a similar situation with EU going in one direction and the U.S. going nowhere or in a slower direction, but it turned into fragmentation and state-level privacy regs. Is that possible to happen in product liability, do you feel?
Oh, yeah, sure, certainly. And California would be one of the ones, but at the same time, California would also undermine its own economy if it did that.
Oh, really interesting. Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point. They're motivated there. Okay.
You know, this whole bringing the whole privacy and EU back into this topic. I was having a conversation with a former colleague, and they're in the legal space, and they were mentioning that, you know, when GDPR came out, you know, you had a lot of noise, a lot of around, you know, obviously taking care of privacy and noise. I mean, people didn't understand what to make of this GDPR, what the implications were, what the fines were. And you know, but that was, what, 6-7 years ago. Fast forward now. And what he said to me was that there's not a lot of GDPR fines at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if that's, yeah, I mean, that was something I always thought about. I always thought about the literal reg says up to 4% of turnover, or aka revenue. Right. And then the bad risk managers, bad lawyers said, oh, OK, what's our revenue? 4% of that is our entire annualized loss expectancy. It's worth spending all of that, which it's just to your point. They didn't pull, you know, they didn't fire all the bullets every single time. Every company under that was brought under a GDPR action did not get hit with 4% of turnover.
Add to that statement, what my former colleague stated was, that he asked me, have you seen the state of privacy software to protect privacy? And has it actually grown? Has it actually exploded? And I was like, oh, you're right. I have not seen, I mean, I would not personally invest in any privacy company at the moment.
There's been some good ones, but I will tell you this. I think the companies that are really successful in the privacy space are in a bit of a panic for a revenue diversification right now. I don't think they're counting on that being, you know, that got them somewhere, which is great. But now they're like, okay, how can we also be security? Because that's going to stick around a little bit longer, and it's a little bit wider spread than just privacy.
Yeah. Which makes me connect to this liability. AI, absolutely. But this whole liability of new products in EU, it might create a lot of noise. I just, you know, fast forward 5-6 years and see what happens. I don't know if it's going to have teeth.
Yeah. Well, closer to home, speaking of liability, about that CrowdStrike bit, right? So first of all, it's always fun to do a stock check. trading around $330 last I checked, or north of $325. So CrowdStrike has come back a pretty good bit. I think that's even independent of the market swing, you know, that came off the election. So that's coming back. And that's also, despite the ongoing litigation with Delta in particular, and the latest news I saw was about a suit against Delta from CrowdStrike to establish some fact. But what I keep thinking about here is, if this really gets drug out in court, I assume that CrowdStrike's strategy is going to be to drag any embarrassing practices out for Delta, or at least to threaten to, and then actually fire that bullet if they must. But I would think that's the strongest thing they have, is for people at Delta to say, let's back down here before there's a headline about how our, you know, Windows 3.11 system did X or Y.
Is your risk register discoverable?
Oh, no, that's a really good question. Yeah. I mean, everything is discoverable with the right counsel, right? And so you could bet whoever's working for CrowdStrike right now is looking for precedent, looking for some defense about how they can discover that.
Surely, and there's surely somebody who said, "Hey, we should make the system more resilient to, you know, outages." And if there's a decision made to say, "Oh, mm-hmm. no, don't worry about that," well, good luck with that, Delta.
Well, I mean, we have a harbinger of this. How about the SolarWinds e-discovery? How about the chats? How about the? I mean, that's the worst, right? The risk register, I'd say, it's chances that it didn't have, and this isn't a Delta thing, just most companies do a crap job of maintaining a risk register, so that might be lucky for them. But I bet there's a whole lot of chats that say, I can't believe we still run this, or, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. We're going to get owned any day. People just talk, right? And is that free game? Well, if it was for SolarWinds, why wouldn't it be for Delta?
Yeah, yeah. And these aren't security issues as much as just the fact that it can't they even mentioned it in their claims, which is that Delta had a really robust, resilient architecture. Well, did they really, right?
Yeah.
Well, clearly they didn't. And who pointed that out, and what were the arguments internally around that? I mean, all that's going to be discoverable. And that's why I was mentioning the risk register. The risk register, in theory, should capture that. Maybe they didn't capture that. That's a problem of itself, right? Anyway, the point is, I think your point is right that if we were to bet on CrowdStrike just as much as we're betting on Delta here, I can see Delta backing down and settling for something next month.
Well, and here's what's really interesting, just putting myself hypothetically in the Delta seat. If I feel that way and I know all of that and I think, oh, we got to be careful here, at the same time, I have my shareholders breathing down my neck saying, oh, these guys ruined you. What are you going to stand there and take it? Aren't you going to do something? And I can't tell them, no, our infrastructure is crap. We can't do this.
Yep.
So it's a rock and a hard place, huh?
Yes. I think this is, I was going to go there. I believe this is potentially driven by their shareholders, by folks who, I'm sure there are some shareholder lawsuits going against Delta on this. You know, it's common practice, like Jerry and I think Sunil, you said it before, it's just common practice of doing business. You put that as a line item, it's going to cost me 1%, 2% of my total budget for this year. And they just budget it.
Yeah, it's something else. I mean, what a balancing act, right? And then if they go down this road to defend themselves against the shareholders and say, yeah, don't worry, we're chasing them down. And if CrowdStrike prevails on your infrastructure was antiquated, then those same shareholders are coming back and suing them about having antiquated infrastructure and hiding it from them, right? And then you got SEC actions, everything else. It's a hairy time.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. Do you think other companies who are potentially thinking about becoming customers of CrowdStrike or CrowdStrike clients today, do you think they're going to have reservations about renewing their contract with them? I mean, if CrowdStrike picks Hardball, would that impact other people using them?
I don't think so. I mean, I get your point. Like, the question isn't, are people going to run away because of this issue? We talked about that a month or two ago.
Correct.
We see that. The question is more, are they going to say, oh, they fight really hard to defend or to push their contract law, and therefore, I don't know. I mean, the fact that all of them are not suing them to the extent that Delta is kind of implies that they have to say Delta's being a little bit over the top here, I would think. I mean, because what if they didn't play hardball and Delta just, won in short order? Well, then all the other customers would line up, too, to get their hand out, right, to get their piece of the pie. Hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, this is one to keep watch of. I suspect that there will be some more developments of this in maybe the coming weeks or coming months. So we can expand the CrowdStrike stock price watch segment to be the litigation the litigation segment as well. All right, guys. Well, look, we're just about out of time now, so I just want to thank you guys. As always, this is fun. No shortage of topics, and I think that's going to be true for quite a while to come. So thank you, and thank everyone for tuning in.